I would say that proceed with caution. The idea that, you know, I'm just going to rebrand myself as a speaker and go out and start making money is a pipe dream.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Joe M. Turner, speaker, magician, mentalist, blogger, Mensa member, and International Vice President for the International Brotherhood of Magicians, is my guest this week. I spoke with Joe while in Jacksonville, Florida, at a recent board meeting for the IBM. Joe spoke on my podcast at the IBM convention in Phoenix in 2013, and I received quite a few positive comments about the business tips he shared. He is quite an interesting fella, having done just about everything in and around magic. He is perhaps one of those guys who, although well-known in his own area, is not as celebrated outside Atlanta, Georgia. He has won Magician of the Year in Atlanta and will soon be much more well-known internationally when he takes over the international presidency of the IBM in Jacksonville later this year at the convention. He often appears on television news shows and is in demand as a speaker as well as a mentalist and magician. In this podcast, Joe talks about both performing and speaking as well as blogging. He gives some great advice on these subjects, too. I should also point out that Joe is one of the best at performing the memorized deck. Towards the end of this podcast, he shares his trial-and-error experiences and thoughts on how one can go about learning this card sequence. Well, enough from me. Let's hear it all in Joe's own words here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I'm in Jacksonville, Florida for a planning committee for the convention that we're going to be having with the International Brotherhood of Magicians later this year. Just to plug that, it's going to be July 15th through the 18th, so be sure to sign up. Go to magician.org, and don't forget to register early. Try to get a good price on this. And I have with me then incoming, well, soon-to-be president, Mr. Joe Turner, Joe M. Turner. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how's it going, Scott?
Very good. Now, your title actually with the IBM is?
International President-elect.
Which means that after Sean Farquhar, this is going to be then your year.
Correct. I will be installed in July.
Okay. That's going to be kind of exciting. I mean, you've been a member of the IBM for how many years?
Oh, my gosh, since 98. So not that many, actually,
wow.
In the grand scheme of things.
Well, you're a young guy.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And you really didn't have political aspirations. It just got busy and...
Once you start working at a local level and... someone who's willing to take on some tasks and maybe exert some leadership, then people at another place will see that happening. And for me, I decided to become involved in my local ring and then decided to run for office. And we had some successful years with that and grew our membership at Ring 9 in Atlanta. And some other people in the ring, Rolando Santos was involved, and he ended up riding for the Linking Ring. And bit by bit, we just seemed to find the next step. And I ended up being appointed TVP for a while in Georgia. I worked on the membership committee. Then it was suggested I might be interested in being on the executive committee, which I did that and made it through and served on the executive committee for the three-year term.
Did some committee work.
Committee work, convention committee. I was the registration chairman for one of the conventions, one of our international conventions. So bit by bit, all of the things stacked up, and then the time came for nominations to go up in the leadership of the IBM. I actually deferred for a year. My daughter's senior year in high school was this year. This was the year that I would have been international president had everything gone according to the original sort of idea.
Yeah.
But I deferred for a year and changed places with Sean. And so there was no guarantee that it would come back around to me, but it did. So it was very nice.
Well, a lot of times people have asked me about how one progresses up through the chairs and gets involved, you know, with an organization. Now, I know a lot of people really are not joiners, it seems like, today, and organizations in general, not just the IBM, but the SAM and
Magic Circle and any other organization, JC's, Lions sure. Club, and whatever, seem to be lacking in membership. You know?
Well, I mean, it's systemic across every organization, and I'm involved with business organizations, churches, magic clubs, you name it, any kind of organization. Most of them have experienced a reduction of membership. Anyone who is motivated to be a leader, whether in a local level or a state level or a national level, is probably just intrinsically wired to look for opportunities to say, well, what if we try it this way? Or it might be better if we looked at this. And so there's just, if those kinds of thoughts have ever occurred to you, mm-hmm. then you've probably got a leadership bone in your body
yeah.
that you know, you can envision things being better because they're done in a different way, or there may be some efficiency that you could capture, or you just have a vision for the way things ought to be. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's whether it's in a local club or whether it's in your Sunday school class at your church or mm-hmm. the way your kids' PTA group is run, whatever it is, we've all probably had those feelings of, this just doesn't seem quite right, if only this or if only that were different. And if you're the kind of person who is willing to take the next step beyond saying to yourself, if only this, and say, well, that could be.
Yeah.
If we tried this, and you come up with a solution, or you have an idea of trying something different, and you're willing to get your hands dirty, then you'll move up. That's
one of those things. If it's going to be, it's going to start with me.
Right.
I think it's important. I heard so many people who will stand back and say, well, I think you should do this, or the organization should do this or that, or the church should be more involved with these activities or whatever, and then set back and throw all these barbs, if you will, or
sure.
suggestions, which are good suggestions, but really not use their hands, you know, in coming up with the idea.
Well,
physically.
Yes, that 80-20, right?
Yeah.
But the idea is, I think anyone can develop more leadership skills, mm-hmm. but it's that you have to commit to actually actively participating in something and contributing at a level that you haven't in the past, mm-hmm. and possibly with no return on that other than the fact that you saw your vision accomplished in some way. And I did not join the IBM because I wanted to be president of the mm-hmm. IBM. I did not run for the executive committee because I had no intention of being president until much, much later. Mm-hmm. I joined the club and decided to be a leader because I thought our meetings could be run better. I thought we could have more active participation in our local ring meetings. And I thought that we could incent people to perform more frequently, so that there was a time when our meetings, it was difficult to get people to actually perform. They just sat around and talked about magic, but nobody really did any. And so, once that discontent is identified, which is, I mean, it's a valuable thing, but you've got to do more than complain. You've got yeah. to say, okay, well, what can I do to make a difference on that? And what I did, and a few of us who joined the ring at that time, we saw that it just wasn't really, you know, exciting. We said, okay, we're going to commit to perform at every meeting.
Right.
And whether anyone else does or not, these four or five of us, we're going to commit that every month we're going to show up. If we're at the meeting, we will perform. And that takes hold, and the meetings become different. Now, that I didn't have to be president of the IBM to do that. I didn't even have to be president of my ring to do that. It's just individuals who have a vision that things could be better or different have to take action.
Right.
That's it.
Now, you do a lot of motivational speaking, which I guess is not really the right term anymore, but just do speaking engagements, basically
right.
motivating people. Do you talk about this in your speeches?
The act of leadership, or I've written about it in some of the materials that I've published on that, about things don't happen until someone takes action. But it's common sense. I mean, anyone listening mm-hmm. to this knows that inherently. It's just the way life is, that nothing happens in your life until you commit to do something differently than you've done before.
Right.
And nothing's going to happen in your magic club until some individuals make a personal decision to act differently
yeah.
in the future than they have in the past. And I wish I could say it's just it, there was some magic bullet or some special thing that you just, oh, well, just push this button, and this button, and suddenly your ring is going to be the most exciting ring in your area. Yeah. And da, da, da. No, you say, well, I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to perform at every meeting. I'm going to rehearse before I do the trick at the ring meeting. You know, I'm actually going to practice the trick before I whip it out at the club. So, I mean, those kinds of things make a difference, and your performance level goes up. But the performances and the expectation of what people what people will expect from you when they see you at a club meeting, that goes up. Well, now you get the guy sitting next to you, the girl on the other side of you, and say, well, okay, the three of us, we're going to perform at every meeting in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do a good job. We're not going to come in not having rehearsed, and that's it. It's not about running for office. It's not about, making the newspaper. All we're going to do is identify – our goal is for the performances at our club to be better than they were last year,
mm-hmm.
and all it takes is us to do it. Now, once that happens, maybe things are exciting. Maybe it is part of your goal. It's like you want to run for the president of your ring or vice president or secretary or something. Get involved. We can probably all tell stories of organizations or rings where maybe an officer was there for many, many years in the same role, and performance went up and performance went down and things got a little – well, they're probably looking for an opportunity to take a break.
Yeah.
And new involved leaders coming in and putting their own stamp of their personality on mm-hmm. a club, that can be a great thing. It can be a reinvigorating thing.
Re-energize the club.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So I would encourage anyone who comes to it, who attends their ring, to start by getting more involved in the activities of their ring. Actively participate at the meetings. Don't sit in the back with your arms folded and just nod and grumble and say, that was all. It's not just about being clapping and supportive and everybody's great. Yeah. It's like, okay, you know what? Get out of your chair and get a deck of cards or get a coin.
Yeah.
Go do something. Yeah. And everybody – and just commit to do that. And if everybody commits to do whatever the next level is beyond what they're doing now, then the whole thing goes up a level. And that's it.
Yeah. Let me take this in a completely different direction.
Okay.
Being from Atlanta, and that's the home of cable news network, CNN.
And
others, yeah, and Turner.
Yeah, Turner's empire is there, and Home Depot, and yeah, it's great.
Right. And FedEx, I think, is that right?
FedEx is in Memphis.
Memphis, I'm sorry,
yeah,
that's right. So the a few years ago, when you mentioned Rolando Santos, this came around because he's, vice president with CNN, and he was a past international president of
yes.
the IBM. And was he the one who helped coordinate the Magic Week? Tell me something about the Magic Week and how that actually came about. Because you performed Magic on television on CNN.
Oh, on CNN.
Yeah, on CNN.
That Magic Week, that was back in 2002. And
what time flies?
I think it was 2002. I'm not 100% positive. It's been so long. But the IBM was hosting the IBM Ring 9 was hosting a Southeastern Association of Magicians convention. Mm-hmm. And he had bounced the idea off many people over the years. It was not – he didn't have the idea
Rolando.
Just for that. Rolando yeah. had already – he was with Headline News at the time. And he had this idea of doing it, and it had not really gotten traction. But once Atlanta was hosting this convention – all the stars aligned, and he was able to tie it into some local event that was going to be there
mm-hmm.
that was drawing talent from, across the nation.
Yeah.
So we had a lot more people to feature than, everybody from the Magic Club is going to – it needed a little more star power. And, we had Michael Amar, for example. So we had people from different regions of the country, and it made it more palatable to the network, I think, to have it as an event.
And so he really pitched this. I remember talking with him, and he was saying, in a way, kind of his neck was on the line of trying to say the Magic is going to work on television, particularly on a news program.
Right. Well, I mean, they had done other featured days mm-hmm. with different types of topics, so I don't think that he was – you know, risking his neck completely. Yeah. But the idea that it was magic was very different.
Yeah.
And to bring magicians on and really shine a light on the art form as he did, as he allowed others to do, and you know, the different net news anchors that were participating that day, magic really did get a boost in public visibility.
And for those who are not familiar with that or didn't see it, of course, again, it was over 13 years ago here.
Right.
Tell a little bit about kind of what went on, some of the people who were on, Dan Garrett and everybody else, Michael, and what kind of magic they did, how they interacted with the anchors.
Well, headline news was somewhat different in those days, too, than it is now as a network. In those days, Rolando was the president of the network of headline news. And because of that, you know, they have the morning show, and they had the anchors during the later part of the morning, and they had different anchors at different parts of the day, and then reporters who would do interviews. And it was organized a little bit differently. But they had Ken Scott on. And he was really focusing. I think he had his rabbit, and he was a little more of that school magician, kid show flavor, very exciting. And he was on that morning. Dan Garrett was on. Jessica Reed was on, the oldest of the Reed sisters, and she did Dove Magic on Headline News. And the idea there was to feature, obviously, the female participation in the art, a young person who was a competitor, and talk about competitions. And so, let's see, Dan Garrett was on, Robert Bingle was on, Michael Amar was on, I was on.
Mm-hmm. And how did this come about as far as the news segment? Was it on once an hour, or how?
It was throughout the day and into the night, and some of the things that had run earlier in the day were repeated at different. I don't know if it was every hour on the hour.
So it wasn't necessarily live.
Some of them were live, but then repeated.
Gotcha.
And then mine, actually, because I was chair of the convention, I had gone in the day before and taped my segment with Sachi Kodo, was the person who interviewed me, and so I was back at the convention working when my spot ran, but many of the spots were live. They were recorded and then rebroadcast an hour or two later, or even later in the day. Mm-hmm. So even the live performances got more than one show.
What was that like? I mean, as far as going in the studio and preparing for that, did you have to tell the director to make sure they get this camera angle? You tell them in advance what you're going to be doing? It was a surprise for them. What's your advice from working on television?
Well, that was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime situation because I knew in advance once they had determined, well, these are the people we're going to ask to participate, and you're going to have about this much time, and so on and so forth. I knew some of the people were going to go in live and just wing it, but since I knew I had to tape mine, I thought, well, when am I going to have 3.5 minutes of time on CNN again in my life? Probably not. So I actually wrote the opening script. I emailed basically the intro to and questions for what I felt prepared to talk about at the time, and they followed it. She loaded the script from my email into the teleprompter and read my intro as given. And so I was really able to plan the way that time would be spent in a different way. And I knew I was going to do this routine for a bumper with no speaking, just a visual bumper that would happen before my segment. And then I would do this routine and this routine in the segment when I was being interviewed. I gave them the websites that I wanted to come up and be highlighted on text on the screen during my interview. So they knew in advance everything that I was going to do. So I had the opportunity to script that. In general, going on television, you don't have that opportunity in my experience. And the promotional things that we've done for various IBM conventions or even other Atlanta television that I've done, you go in and you have, well, this is the routine I'm planning to perform, but you have to be ready to go if they, well, we don't really have a table, so in this area we just want you to stand with the reporter in front of this monitor and do something.
Right.
So I would advise having something that doesn't require a table. And or if you do need a table, carry one with you. Just versatility and flexibility and having a variety of material ready to go.
It's something that's visual, I would imagine, as opposed to mentalism.
Well, yeah, visual, obviously. They want something that's going to look good on that screen.
Right.
Color, some kind of striking color can be helpful. They're going to have their set dressed, and there's going to be a monitor or some kind of graphic behind you with their station logo
right.
most of the time. In Atlanta, I've done it in front of a monitor where they had a graphic with a top hat and something. There was National Magic Week and things of that nature. But whatever the case, something visual, but more than that, it's something that you know you're going to do a good job with. It's not something you tried to learn the day before, and I'm just going to wedge this into this interview because I think the colors are good. It needs to be something that you know cold. And
that's something important, I think, now, particularly in the YouTube age, and more so than it was over a decade ago, because now people are going to record that, and if it's something that's lousy or messes up, that's what's going to be your legacy to live on YouTube.
So. Well, it could end up anywhere, and that's not to say that I've been 100% perfect on everything I've ever done. We all have been put on the spot or things happen, and we just have to manage. But if you know in advance that you're going on for an interview, there's really no excuse not to have something from your repertoire that you've just got down. I think, and we all overestimate how well we've rehearsed, I think.
But also it's a way that they edit the thing. I did a show then one time they were showing magicians working in the hospital around Christmas time, for an example, and I was doing an invisible deck. And that whenever I had a card come out, that the line I used to use was to say, oh, sometimes, they say, what is your card? So sometimes I missed your card, but not this time,
But they cut it.
And made it look like, but magic doesn't always work. Yes, it does. You just
cut it. Well, that's what editing is. You're not the first person to be caught by editing in a television spot, I'm sure, or radio. But just the rule of thumb, I would say, is start. If the most important thing is it's something that you know you're going to perform well.
Yeah.
And that you know from your own personal experience that you can be entertaining with another human being with this material and not have to worry about whether you're going to drop it or lose it or not be able to execute and complete the trick.
Right.
So foolproof material. Now you start looking at the texture of it. Is it colorful? Do I think it is going to pop well on the screen? How visual is it?
It's not going to be a sucker thing that makes your anchor person
look. Yeah, you don't want to make the anchor look foolish. Obviously, you'd like to be invited back to perform there again.
I asked Josh Shea about that once, about working at the Today Show on Harvey and Kathy Lee, because Kathy Lee just goes crazy and tries to make
people.
You don't know what she's going to be doing. But he was told beforehand, pretty much let her do what she wants to do, or you're not going to be asked back.
Right.
Well,
I haven't had the opportunity to perform with someone of that stature,
celebrity,
being the celebrity. That dynamic probably changes significantly compared to, your excellent news reporter from a station that you're performing appearing on, but. You're playing in their playground, and so it's just good manners to not make them look foolish. I mean, they control everything, and you're there by their gracious invitation to promote whatever it is you're promoting, yourself, your show, your convention, whatever it is.
Right.
And so I think that it's just good manners to be prepared and to treat the other person with respect. So that, you look good, they look good, everybody goes home a winner.
Well, along that line, as far as promoting yourself, you have a blog that you write also, which is what?
I have a blog on my website, turnermagic.com. It is it has not been updated in the last couple of months.
Okay.
I mean, I did something this week, but there was a kind of a gap after.
But how do you go about writing a blog? I know a lot of people have blogs, and others might be wanting to, but they kind of feel like, well, if I don't keep it up, then people are not going to keep following me, and I want to have good content. How do you develop the content that's going to be on there, and what kind of content do you post?
Well, there's some truth to that the steady flow keeps people involved and keeps people engaged in what they're doing, so that they would want to come back. But you don't have to do it every day. I know some people who they blog every day, or they say, I'm going to do it every week. Whatever schedule you pick is, I think, personal preference. As far as the kind of material that I choose, I write about things that I'm interested in and things that I think my clients will be interested in.
And when you say clients, do you have a specific clientele? I mean, I like to work within the energy industry. I mean, sure. I have a lot of other people outside, but I try to focus it towards them, but in companies in general. But do you try to focus a particular segment of the...
I haven't identified like a sector of like I'm going to be the energy or education or insurance or financial services or something like that, because the messaging that I've chosen for myself, that I don't want to go into detail on all of the details, but it has some applicability in different types of businesses. And so what I've done is I've said, well, what is, and this would be for anybody, how do I want people who find this blog to interpret who I am? Mm-hmm. What kind of resource do I want to be seen as? And if you can answer that question, then that's what you write about. And it may have some keywords or some industry terms that fit the types of people that you're trying to reach. But, I mean, the number one thing is, what can you credibly opine about? Mm-hmm. You have to have something.
You're an expert in your field.
You have to be an expert on something, and it you can't just go out and say, "Well, I'm Joe Turner, and this is my petroleum industry blog." Well, that makes no sense whatsoever. Or if you've never managed a team, you're not going to write a management or team building blog.
Okay.
If you've never led an organization at any level, you're not going to write a leadership blog. But you find something that, it relates to what you feel like you are.
You write about what you know.
A credible authority to
sure.
offer opinions and insights on. And then you choose a schedule. And then as far as brainstorming the content, one good approach is to look at that overall topic that you find yourself interested in and see if you can break it up into chunks. If you're marketing... a marketing person, you might say, well, this is how I think marketing should be done in digital and the social media and print and television and other things. And then within each one of those, you start breaking it up into the chunks. And then you might find a challenge or a problem that is facing people who make decisions in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
And then pair that challenge up with each of the ways that you chunked it out. Well, what would that look like for someone who's doing Facebook marketing? What would that look like for someone who's doing broadcast marketing? What would that look for something like? What would answering that question look like for someone doing this kind of marketing? And each one of those now becomes a possible blog topic.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's helpful to break your blog topics into chunks that, they're 3 or 4 or 5 bullet points. And very an effective way of getting a good structure for your article is say, well, these are, 5 key lessons for people who are trying to advertise.
I think people like lists, and also things
lists
like top 10
easy,
or whatever.
Top 10 lists, but and things like that. But I think the idea is people know in advance, this isn't a 2,000-word magazine article. This is going to be a 400, 500, 600, 700-word blog
right.
post, and it's going to have 5 sections. And I know from the headline that I can probably just scan those 5 ideas and get the gist of it.
Right.
I think that is helpful. I don't always follow that formula. It's not a recipe for everything, but it's a good rule of thumb. And it helps if I have 15 ideas, well, I can probably get anywhere from 3 to 5 posts out of those different ideas if I chunk it out like that. There are places you can go online that are idea generators for blogs.
Right,
you can put in some keywords and some ideas of things that you're interested in, and it'll just randomly start putting words together and start throwing out ideas. And sometimes that can be a good way to.
So that's another question, that all these blogs are ideas and things that are of your making, as opposed to you summarizing something that has already been written by someone else?
There have been other people that once in a while they do a blog that is sort of a review of or my thoughts on. And maybe you've read a recent book in your field Or maybe there's been a really important article that came out about something that happened in your industry. Writing a response to that or a review of that can be an effective way to generate ideas for a blog, too. Frankly, it can be the genesis of an entire book. If you recall, there was the book Blink. That came out about how we make decisions, and sometimes the best decisions we make are the ones that are very quick and are not snap judgment, but just using your intuition to because, right. And that became a very well-known business book. Mm-hmm. Well, someone took that idea, flipped it around completely, and said, "This is why that's wrong," and wrote a book on critical thinking and analysis, right. And called it Think.
Okay.
And so the book was not Blink, it was Think, and it was basically a book-length answer or counterpoint to the book that had been published. Now, it's certainly not going to make the same level of sales as the first in the market,
right.
But it was a good genesis for an idea. So you could read, pick a journal in an industry. It could be, as you said, energy, or it could be
pharmaceuticals.
It could be whatever.
Consumer
pick an
electronics,
industry.
Yeah.
And you read an article, or you do some research and say the article in this field that made the biggest stink in 2014 was this. Well, I'm going to find a way to write about the opposite of that, and
take
a contrarian view,
and
see if I can make some coherent points in defense of that other point of view. There's a guy named Alan Weiss. I think contrarian is his actual title.
Okay.
And he makes a very good living as a consultant, basically by telling everybody, no, don't do that. Don't do that. This is wrong. All of your preconceived ideas are completely wrong. And he's very nice about it, but he's kind of it's his character to be against it.
Right. Yeah,
so,
negative, yeah.
So it's funny in a way, but it's also... He's got the credibility to back up his point of view, and so whatever ideas he offers as counterpoint, he's got 30 or 40 years of business experience that he can call on to give that some teeth.
Right.
So he's not just being contrarian for the sake of that. He's actually got credibility to back up his point of view.
Right, so. Right. And I would say that one of the things not to do within a blog would be to, you could be contrarian, but not adversarial, where that you're, calling out somebody, telling them wrong, and get into something that might be politically or religiously against whatever. I mean, look at who your market is.
For a magician, and like I say, it all... goes back to the very first question I said was, how do you want the people who read this blog to see you? Mm-hmm. What kind of resource do you want them to consider you as? And there are plenty of examples of people who have made millions and millions of dollars by directly and purposefully offending half of the population of the country.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And pick your politics, and there's examples on the left, examples on the right. So... it's possible. I'm not saying it can't be done,
sure.
But that's just not who I am.
Yeah,
I'm pretty mild mannered, all American kind of a guy. That's just kind of who I am. It's my character. But there's plenty. I mean, look at Dan Sperry. Dan Sperry bills himself as the anti conjurer. He's like, he's doing magic, but it's like the opposite. He's almost pivoting off of what magic is perceived generally as to create this character. And could it be offensive to some people? Yeah, it probably could. It probably is off-putting. But that doesn't matter, because he can be wildly successful with this other segment of people who that appeals to. And so if you decide you want to write a blog saying that, some outrageous thing, and you've got the passion or experience to back that up, and that's who you are. You're going to embrace the consequences
and
of that.
And you're willing to, exactly.
You're going to embrace the consequences of that and say, I want to be the, I want to be the Bill Maher, or I want to be the Rush Limbaugh, or I want to be the, just to pick sort of.
Yeah.
And say, I'm going to alienate this group on purpose in order to be amazingly embraced by this group.
Yeah.
If that's your strategy, then that's what you would choose to write about. And of course, you're going to write things that are going to be considered outrageously appealing by some and outrageously obnoxious by others. And but success comes in different. There's different strategies to achieve it.
Well, that's not something that a lot of magicians do. I mean,
don't do that. Magicians are not, and generally speaking, most magicians are. In my experience, I can't speak from empirical evidence. I've not interviewed every magician in the world. But, you know, a lot of magicians, in my experience, they want to be perceived as appropriate, friendly, family-friendly. Yeah,
middle of the road.
Middle of the road.
They're not going to take a Dan Sperry kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah. Not a risky investment.
Yeah.
There's no risk involved with having this kind of entertainment at your event. And what you're going to get is kind of what you expect. And mm-hmm. so make that sort of trading on the comfort mm-hmm. of magic as a safe place to have entertainment or a safe form of entertainment. And so for that, the people who want to be successful would probably write about, these are, great ways to, make your party successful in addition to magic, or these are some neat ideas for setting up the way your party looks. Maybe you could, I'm just using birthday parties
exactly.
as an example, but if I were doing library shows, then I would be like, well, gosh, the people who book me are librarians or their assistants. What makes them excited? Well, this is the latest information on preserving rare books, and this mm-hmm. is really cool. Or this is, new ways to organize data.
Interesting.
And so I might write about things that are of interest to people in that sector or that world, whether it relates to magic necessarily or not. Just to be, because I want to be seen as interested in the same things.
I think that's part of the key. There is, you want to be a friend. In other words, people will book friends. They like to engage other people in conversation, and if they see you as a friend, because they know more about you and where you stand. So by creating a blog and helping and sharing some ideas outside of magic or outside, I mean, there's a whole world out there aside from magic. And
A friend, but also a resource.
Yes.
A friend, but also a resource.
And a respected authority.
If you can achieve respected authority, then that's great.
Yeah.
But even if you can't get there, just a ready resource mm-hmm. or a good resource is a pretty good place to – that's a pretty good place to stand.
Yeah.
If I know I'm in, my clients' heads as – that's the kind of question I might ask Joe about, or I wonder if Joe's ever written anything about that, or that reminds me of something Joe did. All of those are good. All I need is for me to appear in their mind, at one moment where I wasn't trying to market to them, I wasn't trying to sell to them, they brought it on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the benefit of sharing content that you develop, that you write, or that you find, is that even when you're not selling them, you live in their head. So
yeah. Well, I said that you do a lot of magic, obviously, then, too, but you have been getting into, over the last several years, into more speaking engagements. And in doing that, do you find that you're doing less magic and more speaking, or do you tie in the magic by making a point dramatically using the magic?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Even when I was doing just straight out magic, I think there's enough teacher in me that I always felt like there was always a moment where I was trying to use it to achieve some purpose beyond just we're having a great time. Now, sometimes it was just there for fun, but once I got in front of some larger groups, I felt like there's just part of me that wanted to be not just entertaining but also relevant. Mm-hmm. to what was happening. Having come from a management consulting career, I just felt like maybe I saw something or I heard something or I experienced something that happened in that organization. I was like, I can help them. Card tricks aside, even if I didn't know a magic trick at all, I still have something of value to share with them just from my experience.
Sure.
So the magic was really a way to sort of lubricate that message and sneak it in when they weren't necessarily expecting it. People discovered my clients, in building relationships with them as a magician, found out about my consulting career and then would start to ask me to do that on purpose. Mm-hmm. Can you kick off our meeting, but these are some key points, and would you mind, can you relate to that? And we've all done customized magic.
Absolutely.
You know, from a trade show booth or a product launch or some marketing event. So it's kind of a little more emphasis on that, an outgrowth of that experience was taking it from, well, now I'm not standing at your trade show booth trying to sell your message to, you know, potential buyers.
In short sound bites.
But, you know, I'm just going to take that and build on it in a larger form. And so instead of writing a commercial, I'm going to write a sitcom, or I'm going to write a longer form, a short story about it. I'm not explaining myself well for a professional communicator, but the idea is that it was an off-growth from customizing magic. It was sort of a next step, but a next step that was credible for me given my background.
And so sometimes you give speeches without using magic at all.
That is true.
Okay.
I did it on purpose that way for a while, saying I'm going to give some speeches that have no magic whatsoever. I've stopped doing that. I think I did it to prove to myself that I could, mm-hmm. but now there's...
And how long are your speeches? I mean, 45 minutes, a half hour?
It depends. I mean, some of the material that I have spoken on has gone, you know, an hour and a half.
Wow.
But I like a 75-minute, an hour and 15 minutes is a good zone for me, but I also like the 45 minutes.
Okay.
Was working on a deal earlier today with an event that I'll be opening a conference for them, and they only want 30 minutes. So that's going to have to be
tight.
And ready to go. But also that's with the understanding that I'm not going to be able to delve into material as if it were my keynote, my own mm-hmm. personal material. They've given me some particular messaging that they want, and I'm going to build around their content.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different, but I can do that in 30 minutes.
And so you're still covering some of the same content, but you're just not going into the great detail. It's more of an outline, bullet point kind of a...
Well, for them, there's only... I mean, in 30 minutes, I didn't want to take more than 3 points.
Yeah.
I mean...
And you're doing any magic with that?
Yeah. There will be 3 things that I use to illustrate those points.
Some people have been trying to get into speaking because it's so much, it's not easier, but necessarily, but you're carrying a lot less material with you as far as props and everything.
It depends on what you do.
It does. Yeah. You know, a buddy of mine, Scott Hollingsworth, was telling me how he got involved with this, you know, many years ago, in which that he had done a show, and afterwards, during the show, that the guy was running late who was going to be their keynote speaker, who was going to be following him, and so he kept doing more and more things, and the host was saying, you know, stretch it, finally, you know, okay, he's here, go ahead and cut, and so he did, and then after this guy came out, and, you know, he had a little clipboard, and, you know, took out some papers and read it, and afterwards that the lady was saying how much that she enjoyed his magic, and thanks for going overtime and everything, and here's your check, and then saying this guy was great also, and he happened to see that he made like 5 times as much and carried like next to nothing compared to what Scott was carrying. He thought, maybe start doing some more speaking. So I think more people are magicians are looking at trying to find that lucrative market.
Well,
and joining the NSA, is it NSA?
Yeah. I would say that proceed with caution. The idea that, you know, I'm just going to rebrand myself as a speaker and go out and start making money is a pipe dream. You have to have credibility and something of value to be successful. And if you're going to deign to get up in front of someone and go beyond entertainment, as I said before, but to be relevant to them, that's a step. And it's not a step that I think most magicians in general are necessarily equipped to make or even want to make, because there's a lot of effort and life experience that goes along with that. Now, there's plenty of people who say, well, you know, I'm going to be this motivational, you know, person, and therefore I don't need this. I'm just going to be there to get people revved up. And I don't know. That didn't resonate with me. It's not the kind of person I am, speaker or not. And so I couldn't embrace that side of speaking. It just felt sort of artificial to me.
Yeah.
And it's really about being true to who you are and having a message that you truly believe in, that you have the credibility to speak on as an authority in some way, and you actually are good at the magic that you're going to embed with that. And I would caution people about saying, well, hey, those speakers make so much money. Well, that's also, I think, a lot of figures are inflated.
Okay.
And so just in the same way it is in the magic industry, I think don't believe everything you hear about what other people are making in different types of performing trade show magicians or speakers or corporate this or library that or whatever the case may be. It's some of it is fish stories, and the fisherman always has the bigger fish than the other guy. So, I don't know. It was a natural outgrowth of the way I performed and the background that I had before I was even in magic. And my clients kind of pulled me over that line. I didn't seek.
How would you start to get some experience like that? In other words, would you start to talk, let's say, to the local, Lions Club luncheons and the Rotary Clubs and say, I'll do some free speeches or whatever to start getting some experience, given, let's say, that you have a topic of something, whether it's, I don't know, time management or something that you've got, you want to feel like you want to be an expert? Or not necessarily feel like, but
right.
you are an expert, where you have some experience.
That seems like a reasonable approach to look for people or groups who need that kind of presenter.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, those are pretty short speaking.
15, 20 minutes, yeah.
So you don't the pressure is off in some ways. As far as it's not a big bite. It's a smaller bite. So that might be a good starting point.
And also to belong to the National Speaking Association, that you're required to do so many speeches before.
They have a pretty intensive list of things that they require.
You just can't pay your dues and the IBM and join Sam the Magician.
No.
Okay.
No. It's going to take some years of work to get over that hump.
Okay. And also would be helpful to write a book, I understand. Because then you have some authority that you're speaking from this base of experience, and you can sell a book in the back of the room.
Right. Yes, and I actually explored that path, but there are a lot of different schools of thought on that, and a lot of, just like the magic industry changes and adapts, other industries do too, including speaking, and there's plenty of different schools of thought on how that should or shouldn't even happen anymore. So I really don't feel comfortable saying, well, yes, you should mm-hmm. write a book, or you should do this, or you should. I'm not convinced that path is the same for everybody, so
okay.
I'm not going to advocate that.
Yeah. I have heard it said once. Well, in fact, I was contacted by Voice of America, I think it was, and they were wanting me to do some sort of a radio broadcast. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what I talk about with magicians has a very limited audience. It's a small group, segment of society, and thank you. And I said, why would I necessarily want to do that? And I continued to explore in the conversation. And he was saying a lot of people will do this because that they will take the recordings, transcribe that, and put that into a book. And so basically each episode or podcast would be a chapter in the book,
People have done that with blogs.
Yeah.
They've compiled their previous writings and so forth and made books out of them. I mean, it's one approach. There's 30,000 stars in the sky, there's different ways to do it.
A few more, I think.
Invisible to the naked eye. Again, let me go back. It's what kind of resource do you want to be seen as?
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel like you want your clients to see you as, the guy who wrote the book on time management, then yeah, you better write one.
Yeah.
But I don't think that everybody wants to be perceived in that way, and so. Just saying, yeah, you should. If you want to do this, you should write a book. I don't think every speaker necessarily needs a book. I certainly, I don't think every some people make a very good impact with podcasts, and that's their thing. And they put out podcasts or blogs, and they don't do print.
Right.
And they don't need to. And it's because the audience that they're trying to reach, they're reaching with a different method. And so,
yeah.
Maybe they don't. So just to say, well, yeah, you should do that. I don't know. I mean, there's not a lot of shoulds.
Right.
The most important thing is be passionate, be credible, be equipped to deliver what you promise and a little bit more. And certainly for magicians, be more than competent at what you do, be excellent at what you do. And I've watched my repertoire. I've peeled and peeled and peeled layers of things that I no longer perform in my regular shows and performances, down to a few things that I just know that I'm going to be able to nail this, I'm going to be able to nail that. And I guess it takes a certain amount of time and maturity and poor showings, mm-hmm. Mistakes made and lessons learned before you realize that's really not for me. But this is where I excel. And so now it changes the way you shop. It changes the way you read in magic once you embrace that. And certainly that's for one small niche of performers, professionals who make a full-time living and they've chosen this particular way of doing it. It may be completely different for someone else. If I had to make a brand new library show every year, well then my outlook on the way that would happen would be completely different, because I would need to develop new materials and relate to new themes in different ways for the same kids that are probably going to come back. And so I go online and I see people say, well, magicians should do this or magicians should do that. I can't get behind that, because there's so many different ways that we do what we do and different types of audiences that we try to reach and different ways that we want to be perceived, that there is no answer to should you do this.
Right.
It depends.
Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and you said a lot of magic words, over there.
Well, we've gone a long way tonight.
A few things. But to change the subject, actually completely different, talk about a memorized deck.
And oh, I love that. Yeah.
You started, because you and Mike Close are the two guys, I think, who do the best. Well, Simon Aronson.
Well, obviously, goes without saying.
Maybe Juan Tamariz, I guess. Maybe a few others. But I think you do a fantastic job with that.
Well, first let me say wow, because to be mentioned in the same breath with people of that stature who I admire so much is amazing. Michael Close, especially. I guess he was probably the first person I ever saw who really did a lot of work with a memorized deck. I remember a lecture he did in Atlanta years ago, and I was intrigued by it, but I didn't pursue it fully. Later on, I picked up a memorized deck, not Aronson stack, not Tamariz, but a different stack. It was actually by a man named Bob Clace, who actually lives down in Florida. He's a Florida magician. He developed a memorized deck, and I worked with it for over a year. And I loved some of the things that were built into that stack and the arrangements that you could arrive at with some pharaohs or some displacements. You would end up in certain configurations that were really more appealing to me than some of the stuff in the Aronson stack. But I eventually settled on Juan Tamariz's stack, mainly because you can shuffle to it from a new deck. And I just that feature appealed to me, that I could just sort of get to it with this fixed, rather than sorting through the cards and having to stack it from basically as a random stack. So so I embraced that, and also because there's a certain part of me that is contrarian, as we were talking about before. And so everybody was going to the Aronson stack, and I said, you know what? I'm going to do Tamariz stack.
Yeah.
And so I did it partly for that reason too. It has changed the way I perform magic, not just cards, but it's changed the way I think about some of the ways I perform other things. Well, just it has encouraged me, because I perform any card called for. It changed the way I do multiple selection routines, and it encouraged me to put a lot more emphasis on not necessarily having this process happen, but it's just this direct magic. I mean, if I asked you to think of a playing card and name it out loud, which card would you say? And they say a card, and you suddenly pull it from your pocket.
Just that fast.
That fast.
Yeah. I just saw you do that today.
Yeah. There's no explanation. There's no dealing piles. There's no put it back in and shuffle and what's your birthday or any of that.
Right. Right?
There's no process.
And there's no index or anything. You said your pocket. I mean, well, I saw you do that today. Of course, you're
no, doing the deck is the index.
The deck is. But, I mean, it was on the table to begin with. They name a card. You just open the lid, pull out the card.
Yeah, and so because of the using the cards in that way and making things so direct, I think it changed the way I want my other magic to feel.
Okay, I see where you're going. Okay.
It made me want to pull away some of the extraneous bits and try to get to a knockout effect more quickly and just really put the spotlight focused down onto the actual experience of the magic. And so in that way, I don't want to get too philosophical. It wasn't this grand revelation, but it influenced the way I think about the way I perform my magic.
Well, most people will who do a stack deck are sure ask this question, how you go about memorizing that.
I started with the method in Mnemonica that Mr. Tamaris gives about making the flashcards and singing the song and putting it on the tape, and I tried that, and it was not. I was just not committed to it in that way, but it didn't work for me to do it that way.
You just hardwired it.
I've studied mnemonics and speak on memory from time to time, and have taught. It takes too long to go through the steps.
Yeah.
And I think Mike Close talks about that in his lecture, too, from years ago. You don't have time in a performance to think about, okay, this is an apple core, and it's in the same picture as a cow. And no matter what the mnemonics are, it still takes brain time. It takes processing time to get. So I had a different approach. I printed out the stack on 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, actually half a sheet, taped it to the dashboard of my car over the air conditioning. I had a 6-hour drive to a gig, and instead of the mistake I made when I learned the first stack was I started at the top and just tried to plow through numerically, and I got really, really good at the first 10 or 15 cards in the stack, but my 30s and 40s were always weak. And I learned them late, and I always was sequentially going through the stack and try to add one more. And now I go through the stack and add one more. But that means you've rehearsed those first dozen
but not immensely.
So what I did was I learned card number one and card number two. Okay, that's good. And then I learned, I've got digits one and two. I learned card number 10 and card number 11. And card number 12. So these are all digits made with 0, 1, or 2.
Okay.
All right?
I see what you're saying. Sure.
And then, so now I'm learning some from the front and some from the teens. And then as I was driving along, I would see mile markers or exit signs or license plates or registration numbers or phone numbers on billboards or whatever. And if it had a 1, then I would do 1, 10, and 11. And if it had a 2, I would do card number 2. And if it had a 1 and a 2, I would do 12. And then I would learn 20 and 21 and 22.
Okay.
And now I could do those. Then once I got all of the things that had all the permutations of 1 and 2, I went back and learned card number 3. And then I learned card number 13 and card number 23, and then 30, 31, 32, and 33. And I would drill myself using the environment around me as the random number generator.
Yeah.
Because this license plate came by and it had a 1 and a 3. So 1 is this, 3 is that, 13 is this, 31 is that. Done. That has a 2 and a 3. Okay, 20, 22. And I would just learn, and then I would add the 4s. And then when you got to the 5, you're done. And so by doing that, what I did is instead of learning one long list, I learned a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here, and those clumps expanded.
Yeah.
Until they finally overlapped each other and I knew the whole deck.
Yeah.
And that way, I just felt like it worked for me. I've shared that with other people. I found it an effective way. It avoided that sequential approach of just learning a stack and then adding one more, learning a stack and adding one more to the end. You over-rehearse the first 10.
Yeah.
and then you just never really feel like you're making progress. But this way I did it, and I didn't need an app on my phone or anything. I just used the environment around me and looked at the random numbers, and there it is. And so whatever the numbers were given, a 1, a 3, and a 4, you've got 1, 3, and 4, 13 and 14, right, 31, yeah. 33, 30. So you've got all of those, 11. You've got all of the permutations of those numbers. And by the time I got to my engagement, the stack was learned.
Wow, just within 6 hours.
That was it.
Wow, that's interesting. I learned the Knights Tour, kind of hardwired that also.
Right.
So that when my wife and I were out for walks in the evening, mm-hmm. that we would just go through there. She would give me a number. Let's say
right.
6, and I would say the number would follow that. I mean, she'd just kind of start in the middle, and then I would say, you know, it jumps to this, this, and this, and then she'd say no. And, you know, it just took a while, you know, to begin with that I was learning just straight through, as you say, the mm-hmm. first 10 and keep on going until I had it. And then after I did, then the practice was each evening to start in the middle of just naming a number and then jumping from there. And if I was wrong, then right. we'd start over a different number.
Well, and once you've learned it, yeah, shuffle a deck. Mm-hmm. And go through it and tell what number every card is. You can do that.
That's another way. Yeah,
you know, once you, but in the initial learning of the stack, the way I did it was by not paying full attention when driving.
So the name of the podcast again is called The Magic Word, and we've already gone through several magic words and that you have shared with us. But what would you say would be, perhaps if not a word, perhaps a phrase or a mantra, something you live by? What's important to you?
Oh my gosh. What is most important to me? My family.
There you go. I knew you'd go say family. I didn't want to put words in your mouth that I.
Well,
knew
yeah.
You
I mean, if we're going to stack it up like that, I would say in all the universe, you know, my wife, kids, and my parents and her parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. Now, if we wanted to limit the scope to business, instead, if I could, it's preparation.
Preparation, yeah.
Preparation. Mm-hmm. If you want to be successful, you have to prepare. You can't go out.
And so when an opportunity presents itself, then you're ready to
then
go.
Then you're ready. Yeah. Preparation. And
yeah.
it goes for a show. It goes for being a leader in your club.
Yeah.
It goes for whether you're going to give a speech or do a trick or whatever it is prepare ahead of time. And you'll just committing to do that will change your results, your outcomes tremendously.
That's great. Thank you very much. That's Joe Turner. Thank you, Joe. You've been great.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Learned a lot more. Hope you guys learned something along the way here as well. So, for the Magic Word Podcast, until next week, this is Scotty out.
Thank you, Joe, for your time and advice. If any of you would like to contact Joe for more information on booking his lecture, or if you'd just like to thank him for sharing his thoughts, then you can reach him at jmt@turnermagic.com. You can follow him on Facebook at facebook.com/turnermagic and on Twitter at turnermagic. And while you're visiting Facebook, don't forget to like us on The Magic Word at facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and count your change before leaving the register. This is Scotty out.